Time now for the College Football Inquirer with Dan Wetzel.
Punish Michigan if that's punish who doesn't play a game. Punish the non-conference duck. Michigan banked on the idea that they could just go undefeated, beat Ohio State, and that would be enough.
SI's Ross Gellinger.
Dan, I'm telling you, man, these Gulf Coast people, man, if it drops below 60, man, that's no fun. We bundle up, man.
And SI's Pat 40.
Do not make a hire based on who loves Auburn. I'm sitting here in Louisville watching Kenny Payne coach the University of Louisville in basketball right now. He was a nostalgia hire who loves Louisville. They're 0-2 losing to Bellarmine and Wright State.
Here's Pat, Russ, and Dan.
Hi, welcome to the pod. And we're going to start with an awful situation involving the University of Virginia. Kind of pride ourselves on this podcast and trying to be an hour for people to avoid real news and stories like this, but there is no avoiding this. Three Virginia football players were murdered on Sunday night. Devin Chandler, wide receiver from Virginia Beach. Deshaun Perry, a linebacker from Miami. Lavelle Davis, a wide receiver from South Carolina. Mike Hollins, a running back from Baton Rouge, is in the hospital and dealing with it's on a ventilator, I believe, and dealing with surgeries. There's another student at Virginia who was injured, apparently not a football athlete. I'm not even going to name the shooter. If he was looking for attention, he can get it somewhere other than here. Former walk-on on the program. And horrific story. They were coming back from a play. They had gone to the theater in Washington, D.C. to see a play, apparently, according to I watched the president's news conference, part of a class, returned on the bus, and this guy started shooting. Horrific, whether they're football players or not, horrific. I think anybody can, you know, these kids were, you know, hailed all over campus for their just everything, personality, their academics, their intellectual curiosity, the way they carried themselves and represented themselves. I just can't, you just don't even want to think about the horrors their families are going through today and every freaking day forward. It never will fade for them, and how senseless this is. So our thoughts are obviously with Virginia and their families in particular. Ross, you were there. You wrote two stories, including one from the scene in Charlottesville I thought was absolutely exceptional, moving, incredible. What take us to Charlottesville and take us to the lawn on and the grounds, as they call it there. But the lawn is this incredible area in the middle of campus that, like, I think Thomas Jefferson laid out. It's one of the most beautiful places on any campus anywhere in America is the lawn at Virginia. And last night was an incredible scene. So what was that like, Ross?
Yeah, it was quite moving. You know, I got here around 4 o'clock in the afternoon yesterday, drove in from DC, and it was kind of, if you were just coming into the city at first, you wouldn't think anything is happening. You had people jogging and people on scooters and people walking about and a little bit of traffic here and there. People were in restaurants and then I started to move through and onto campus. And then, you started to see the banners hung from the fraternity and sorority homes with the jersey numbers and the names of those who died. And then I spoke to some fraternity members who were, their house is about a couple hundred yards from where the shooting happened. They heard the gunshots, actually. They locked themselves, barricaded themselves into the upper floor of the fraternity house. And then I moved over to a prayer service that happened that had more than 250, 300 people at. That was around 5:30. And then I walked over to this football stadium before the big visual on the lawn. And, gosh, there were already, I guess, 200 or 300 bouquets of flowers and notes, you know, handwritten notes. You know, one of the, I guess it was a pretty close friend, obviously, of one of those who died. And he had written, like, they must have went to high school together. And he had written on his high school track shirt. He had a high school track shirt. And the friend must have written in black marker on there, like a message to him, like a personalized message to him, and left the shirt there with some flowers. And then from there, I walked with thousands of students. It was something that I have never witnessed before in my life. Thousands and thousands of students. And I was like walking with them from the dorms and the outside of campus, the exterior kind of fringes of campus, toward the center of campus to the lawn, as you talked about off the top. And, you know, they were talking like normal students would, you know, some of them were even messing around a little bit. And then as they approached the lawn, everybody grew quiet and it was stunning. I walked up upon the lawn and there were already, I'd say, 2,000 or 3,000 students sitting on the grassy area or standing around the outside of it on the concrete. And by the end of it, I'm just estimating there are 4,000 or 5,000 students there. It was just stunning. And they just sat in silence for about 45 minutes and held up candles, held up their phone lights. At one point in unison, they all rose together, just everything's still in silence. You know, there was silence for 45 minutes. And then an unidentified football player stepped forward because the football players were sitting on the steps of one of the old halls there. And the students were basically just staring toward them. They were sitting, staring toward them. And a football player finally like emerged and spoke. And it was just like a short prayer. And then all the students, just like you see a receiving line for a funeral, came up and put their candles or lights or whatever on the steps in front of the football players. And there was about another hour went by. And toward the end, you know, silence was kind of replaced by some weeping and some wailing from the football players. But, you know, I've never seen anything like it. It was just an incredible show of support and solidarity from the student body to their football team.
I mean, the pictures alone on your Twitter are incredible. And I mean, yeah, that's with an iPhone. I mean, yeah, these look like.
Yeah, I mean, that was unbelievable. And that I think you brought it home to a lot of people what a you know, devastated campus looks like just with those photos, and then the words obviously as well. But you know, I just, the one of those things that you hope young people never have to go through, but it seems like it's more commonplace than we would ever like to even worry about when you send your kids away to college or you take them to school in the morning or whatever the case may be. And no answers, right, at this point. Nobody really understands what happened, but just a terrible, terrible thing to have happen for a campus. And as Dan said, yes, for a football team, but they were students, they were regular people. And Virginia is one of those places, right or wrong, that you can kind of idealize as almost a Shangri-La kind of place. It was created with that in mind, kind of by Thomas Jefferson. He was going to build a great American university. You walk around it, it feels special. It looks special. It is, you know, both incredibly old and tradition steeped and also very cutting edge as an academic institution. But it's like any other place in America where terrible things can happen. We hope and pray they don't, but sometimes they do, and hope the students can all kind of persevere and get through this. And the other thing that I was thinking about, and you know, we don't know for sure like what the team dynamic was in this yet. Maybe we'll figure that out. Maybe we won't. Maybe there wasn't much of a team dynamic involved. But you know, for those of us that cover this, the word we hear more than about any in recent years from teams is we're brothers, we have a brotherhood. And you just, it is an incredible shock to the system to see somebody who is one part of the brotherhood do this to people who are another part of the brotherhood. And even if that person hadn't been on the team for a long time, again, we don't know the relationships, but, you know, that again, it can happen anywhere at any time, but to see it happen within a team structure, given knowing how teams operate and are built and try to have a culture of togetherness, is just really stunning and sad.
Yeah, it is a crazy crime, and we'll find out more eventually. Apparently, there is no answer that makes it make sense, and there's no answer that brings the kids back. So, and you know, I was moved by one thing on Monday. You know, social media is amazing. It you know, it's obviously could be toxic and terrible, but it also gives voice to all sorts of people that, unfortunately, I've covered these crimes before. There's at Virginia Tech. I've been on different ones on colleges, high schools, all sorts. And, you know, unless a reporter finds somebody, it's hard for them to amplify their voice. But here was a chance for like, hey, you know what? This kid was in my sociology class. I'm the professor. And he, you know, it just, people can just speak up and tell these stories and the amazing stories of these guys. And, you know, look, college football is a big deal, and we're going to get to all the fun and the playoff chase, and there's all this money, and there's guys getting Bentleys and all of that. But at the heart, most of these kids are going and trying to get an education as part of the fun of playing college football. Or they're not going to, these were not NFL prospects, and they probably knew it. And Virginia, in particular, attracts a kid that's saying, "Hey, I want this world class academics," which Virginia, you know, provides. And I want to play ACC football. And the idea that they were spending Sunday on like a lengthy academic trip, right? In the middle of the season is like, I don't know. It's just like, God, man, you know, like there's no good. I'm not saying there's a good or a bad, but it's just like, you know, this is kind of what the whole point of the operation is, right? And so it's like, okay, you play a football game on Saturday, and there's people there, and you're playing Pitt. It's a big, you know, this is high level football. And then on Sunday, you got to hustle, get your treatment in, and then you're gonna go on a bus with a whole bunch of other kids to DC to a theater to a play. And like when I was 20, that would have been like mind blowing, just going to that too, right?
Yeah.
And then you're gonna get back late, and then you're gonna have to get, you know, you got to do all these things, and it's like, it's just. Just an awful situation. We'll find out more. And I don't know how those guys get through this week. I don't know what goes forward with the Virginia football program. Just very, very difficult times. My main thoughts, though, are with those families that, gosh, you drop your kid off at Virginia. He's a football player. And it, by all accounts, these kids, other than the, you know, they're not going to win the national championship, but they're doing great in every other way. And those parents just, you think you're proud and they're safe. And, you know, this is what hits you. And in addition, these are not football players, but there's a, you know, I know the University of Idaho is dealing with four young people were killed in an off-campus residence over the weekend in what apparently was an act of violence, that there's a lot of mystery on that. So, they're not football players. This is a football podcast, but our thoughts are with that. This stuff just sucks. Man, it's not.
Well, and your
senseless crimes.
You know, when I was walking around campus, like you guys said, it was, man, you know, the campus here is beautiful. It's got the rolling hills, and you know, it's autumn, so there's the leaves on the ground, and part of me was like, you know, there. You look around and you just kind of observe things, and you're like, man, this is like the quintessential college campus. And then you look around at, you know, the activity around, even yesterday, and there was normalcy in a way. You know, you saw kids on scooters, you saw kids tossing frisbees, you know, you saw fraternity sorority people like in groups on campus. And then I walked down one street, and it was just lined. It was unpassable. The sidewalk was unpassable because of probably 20 TV crews in TV vans. And then there in the distance was the parking garage where it happened. And it's like, gosh, you know, it was right in the middle of campus. This parking garage is across from the drama building. It's just a couple hundred yards from Fraternity Row, just right in the middle of everything for such a horrific incident to happen. And, you know, I want to mention kind of the news story that we dropped Monday night about Mike Hollins, the running back, he's a fourth victim, one of two survivors. The fifth victim is, yeah, as Dan said, not a football player and is in stable condition. I think that fifth victim had a gunshot wound to the leg. But Mike had a gunshot wound to the back, and they believe the bullet came out of his abdomen. He's got all kind of abdominal issues. Talked to the lawyer for his mother, and, you know, he had surgery, emergency surgery Sunday night. Everything seemed to go well. He'll have another surgery today on Tuesday. They're hoping to take him off the ventilator today. You know, the mom got to see him Monday, got to speak to him. He couldn't speak, really. So he wrote her a note. And, of course, the first note he slid her was, "How are my three teammates?" And, you know, the lawyer, who is really close family friends with the Hollinses, who got really choked up talking about the fact that they, because of his condition, they couldn't tell him what happened to the teammates. They were scared to tell him out of fear for his health, his own health. So, you know, here we sit. I'm not sure that he knows that his teammates have died. It's just an awful situation. And God, it just, you know, you're swept up in a lot of emotions because it just should not happen. And it's just this bizarre thing. And we got a little bit of some of the story from the lawyer who talked to the mother. And the mother of Mike Hollins talked to witnesses who were on the bus. Obviously, there were a lot of witnesses on the bus. That they pulled into the garage and the suspect asked one of the football players about a video game. And as soon as the player answered in response, he reached into a bag and pulled out a gun and clearly targeted the football players. And the only reason Mike Hollins is alive is because he was at the front of the bus further away from the suspect.
The shootings occurred in the bus, and the players were two never got out of the bus. One was critically wounded. They did get him off the bus to try to get him to the hospital, but he passed away right then. So just it was an ambush, you know, and we don't know the answers. Maybe we'll get them, maybe we won't, but just absolutely horrific and unexpected. So not good, but we'll be on it. Ross is still there, and appreciate that first person account. This is a college football podcast. We do try to have fun, and so we're gonna move on from that as best we can. But we'll get back to it as merits going forward. So this week is kind of that weird week where a lot of the SEC teams play. They save up their dog games. It's always kind of awk. A lot of teams, so it's a weird break week. College football is odd, right? It's just an odd sport.
One of these things that, like, this is one of these things where if you dropped in people who had no idea, they'd be like, "Why?
Right?
Why all of a sudden is Alabama playing Austin Peay now?"
Yeah, it's like, "Hey, their season's ramping up. Yeah, let's just take a break. Let's just we don't want to be too exciting this week." All the actions in the Pac-12, so we'll get to that. But yeah, now the one thing we're running out of weeks, right? We have two more weeks of full boat. What we have not had this year is that week where everybody loses.
Right.
We're just like, you know, there hasn't been this widespread thing. Not exactly expecting that this week, but there are a few games. You know, Illinois is visiting Michigan. The Illini have anything less than the tank. Kentucky is hosting Georgia. Kentucky got anything, you know, in a wild season? Maybe. Maryland is hosting Ohio State, 6-4. Who knows? So there's a few possibilities. You also have Baylor, 6-4, hosting TCU. A lot could happen. Maybe this is that week, or maybe we go through this year without it. I don't know. But certainly we'll get to that. The big games are out west, including the UCLA-USC game, which, even though is the big rival, gets moved up a week on every other year so USC can finish with Notre Dame on the traditional after Thanksgiving rivalry week. Primetime game for USC and UCLA. One of the great uniform games.
Yes.
Always incredible. They bring out their best uniforms. They both got great, iconic uniforms. It's at the Rose Bowl. UCLA blew what could have been a top 10 matchup by losing to Arizona last week, but neither team's got a defense. There is no, we have the letters U, S, C, and L and A, and there's no D in any of those. So that could That's be kind of a fun game. And I wanted to ask this question, talking playoff scenarios, where we did not tape after the, I don't think the rankings are going to have anything interesting. USC finishes with UCLA on the road, Notre Dame, which is now revitalized and could certainly walk in with 8 wins, I think, and then a Pac-12 championship game, which the Utah-Oregon game could be partially deciding. That's also Saturday night. USC doesn't quite control its destiny, but is it as close to anybody as controlling its destiny? By my theory, USC goes, if USC is 12-1, they're going to get the nod over any other one-loss team other than Georgia. And so if Georgia gets to the SEC title game and loses then to LSU, I would think it's LSU and Georgia getting in and USC would be out. But other than that, does USC have the inside track other than that scenario? Would they be above Tennessee at 11-1? Would they be above the Ohio State Michigan loser? Would they be above the ACC teams? Whatever. They'd be above even a 12-1 TCU team, say, if however it would go. Does USC have that other than the Georgia LSU scenario, Pap?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it'd be close. It'd be contentious. It'd be really interesting, but I would like their chances in that scenario. And I did part of the 40-yard dash looking at non-conference scheduling and then just kind of weighing out and doing some numbers on how many Power 5 teams did you play. And the point of it was Michigan, which dumped a series with UCLA that if they lose to Ohio State, having dumped UCLA might be the thing that keeps them out of this. I mean, it makes the Ohio State game must win, I think, because if they're a one-loss team, I think they could be on the wrong side of it. And if you look, I looked at the schedules for like 5 teams that if they end up with one loss, how would it kind of turn out? And USC, starting with them since you brought them up. And by the way, this is the kind of stuff the Pac-12 does to itself, because if they hadn't screwed up, if Oregon hadn't lost at home and blown that game, and UCLA hadn't lost to Arizona, I was going to be in Eugene for Utah-Oregon, and Ross was going to be in Los Angeles for USC-UCLA, and now neither of us are going to either game. So, there we have it. But anyway, USC would have a 10-1 record against 11 Power 5 opponents. Okay, 11 out of their 13 games would be against Power 5 teams, and their one loss would be by 1 point on the road to a good Utah team. So if they can run it, if they can beat UCLA, if they can beat Notre Dame, and they can beat presumably Oregon or a rematch with Utah, that's a strong finish, and it gives them a nice body of work. TCU would also have 11 Power 5 opponents. Clemson would have 11 Power 5 opponents. Tennessee and Michigan would only have 9. Michigan has the 9 period, and they wouldn't have a 10th. They wouldn't have a championship game, and they didn't schedule a non-conference game against a Power 5 team. Tennessee did schedule one on the road against Pittsburgh and won, but only plays 8 regular season games in the SEC. So if you just look at it that, as far if Power 5 is a delineator, and it's not necessarily cut and dried, but if it is, then USC, TCU, and Clemson would all have a step ahead in terms of number of opponents played from that level. And if USC, again, to your point, Dan, wins out, I think that they would have the resume, and they would have one thing that we sure haven't seen very much, and that's geographic balance, and I think that would be appealing to the committee.
Ohio State would have that also, because they played Notre Dame.
If they go to the championship game.
That's right. Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. But they would have that Ohio State, or yeah, because they would have the Notre Dame game too.
Yeah.
All right. Go ahead, Ross.
No. I agree. I think when you look at the first of all, this could be, I don't know. I'm sure maybe it's happened before that we've had we're going to have maybe 4 one-loss teams potentially for the last spot. Was it the year that TCU was like the first year that TCU and them got left out?
First year.
Like Yeah, we had like three or four one-loss teams that were all kind of jockeying.
And TCU Ohio State famously was ranked third. TCU was ranked third.
Right.
Defeated Iowa State 55-3 and got dropped to sixth.
Yeah. Yeah.
I became suspicious of the committee in the first year. They did not get it wrong because Ohio State won the title. Yeah. And then they credited Ohio State having a third string quarterback beating Wisconsin, which is not a factor in any of their lists of things to factor. They just made up the strength of the third string quarterback is not a thing. But yeah, go ahead. So yeah, that was that first year. So
yeah, that was
the first year. That's why TCU is freaking nervous because they've been there. They're like, hey, man, we're three. We won by 40, 52 points. No, six.
Well, there's no – yeah, they probably know there's no margin of error for TCU, right? They can't lose and get in, I wouldn't think. So they've got to – they can't be one of these one-loss teams that gets in. So they've got to keep on running the table, which every week it seems like a – everybody doubts them, including me, that they're going to choke up at some point and lose, and they keep winning. But this could be a year, one of the tougher years, like that first year for the committee, where you've got three or four teams at one loss that you have to choose. But I think USC would probably be in over all those others. But man, there's going to be a case for the Michigan Ohio State loser for sure. I mean, of all those, that would be the one you would think would stack up there and be pretty close. Of course, the SEC is going to have their case too. If like you mentioned, Dan, if LSU beats Georgia in the SEC championship game, you would think it'd be LSU and Georgia would both get in. You know, and if LSU loses to Georgia, then you've got a pretty big argument that Tennessee should be in as well.
Yeah, so it's going to be. So the thing about USC is we just don't know. If you look at their schedule, it's just the way this is shaken out. They have three tough games to go. But they had the easiest road to this I've ever seen. Like, they played Rice. Okay, so that's one non-con. That's easy. At Stanford. Stanford's horrible unless they're playing Notre Dame. Fresno State is not having a great season. Oregon
Fresno's coming back, man. Coming back.
There are. Yeah. All right, Mel, that's their second best win. Let me put it that way. Oregon State is legit. 17-14. They won that. That's a solid win. Arizona State's a disaster. Washington State, they lose to Utah. Then they get Arizona, Cal, Colorado. So they have kind of, and this is just what the Pac-12 gives them, but they've kind of snaked through. So we're going to find out a lot more about USC. I don't know if the USC and that defense can win these next three games. Here's my thing with the committee, if it comes down to these one, because this could be an epic scream. I mean, everyone would be screaming. Punish Michigan, if that's punish who doesn't play a game. Punish the non-conference duck. Michigan banked on the idea that they could just go undefeated, beat Ohio State, and that would be enough. Forget it. That's what you. What I don't want to hear is, well, these people might have better wins, but we don't like their defense, or we don't like game control, or I hate when they start trying to dissect teams. You don't know. I don't care how you win the game. I don't care. If you can win the game, you win the game. And, you know, it doesn't matter what they're off. I hate when they do that stuff. Well, their ranking and the offense, it's like, like, do you win the games? Do you schedule hard games? Do you win them? Do you have better quality of victories? Because that's you win 3-2, you win 55-54, it's a victory. UCLA, USC could win 17-14 at Oregon. They could easily beat UCLA 60-59 this weekend. And it doesn't matter. They won. So that's my thing, is I hate when they become these armchair quarterback. I mean, this stuff never... It's like sitting around before the Super Bowl for 2 weeks and everyone tells you what's going to happen and none of it happens.
Oh, it's absurd. Some of these advanced stats they use. And I know I've went in on this rant before on the pod when I went to the mock CFP that one year and went in thinking this was silly and went out thinking it was more silly because you sit and you use all these advanced stats that they use. You sit in their chair, you use the same computers. And it's like, you know, we're starting to talk about game control and average road, you know, offensive yards. And I, you know, it's so silly. You know, there's only should be a set numbers you look at. And I think one of the big ones is strength of schedule, you know, who you schedule, who you beat. And of course the eye test, quote unquote, where you watch a team and you just kind of determine how you feel about them compared to other teams that you watch. So there should be there's a small group of things that they should look at. Unfortunately, they go deep.
I don't even like the eye test at all. I don't care if you like, I don't care. Like, you could go Vegas lines if you really want to get into it. But like, I think a lot of teams could beat TCU, but guess what? Like, there were a lot of teams that could have beaten Cincinnati last year. Guess what? They, you know, certainly TCU.
None of them did.
All right. Do I think UCLA would last or USC would last in the SEC with that defense? No, I don't. Yeah. But doesn't matter. This is who they played. Let's do this. So this will get a lot easier when there's automatic bids and all that. But this could be one epic fight. And we're talking some big brands fighting this time. Not, hey, we're Boise State. To pay attention to us up here. It's like with Michigan screaming and Tennessee screaming and USC screaming. It's a lot of screaming.
I'm with you, Dan, where it drives me crazy where this becomes a thing where, well, we talked to the football people in the room and they told us that, you know, if you look at the power run game here, you know, that's just going to be really hard for Team X to match up against, or, you know, the three technique's a real weakness for them. And so if the other team attack, don't guess what's going to happen based on your football knowledge. Look at the resume. Look at the performances against the resume and decide on the body of work who should be in, as opposed to, well, they could attack the outer thirds of the cover two extremely well with the passing game. Doesn't matter. That's not the job of the committee to predict what would happen. The job is to pick who had the best season, who did what they needed to do to get into the top four to get to this point. So that's all I care about.
Right.
And so I am much more, you know,
results.
Yeah. Power rankings, whatever the case is.
The quote football people, like, you might have sit there and said, well, this is where is how I coached football. I played football. You could have the greatest football. You could know all sorts of stuff about football. And if you can't line up and power on third and two and get, you know, you got to be able to run the ball. You could go back to some of the greatest football coaches of all time and they would be setting their ways and how they do something. And then, like, all of a sudden, like, Art Briles or Hal Mummy comes along and is like, well, we're going to throw it every time and we're out of the shotgun all the time. And I mean, the old purists were like, you can't play this way. And it's like, well, yeah, hell you can't. And, you know, like, sure you can. You win the game. Doesn't matter. So whatever.
On each one of the selection committees, like Pat was saying, talking about football people, I think there's at least one former coach that's on the committee. And usually, depending on who that coach is, but most of them, from what I have ascertained from talking to people who are on that committee, like you guys probably have too, is the coach in the room is pretty vocal because coaches are vocal and they're loud and they get into all that schematic stuff. And I think at one, you know, for a stretch of 2 or 3 years, I think they're 3 year cycles or stints on the committee, with Barry Alvarez, I think, was one of them. And boy, I mean, he led the room on that stuff. So a lot of these football people they are loud and influential in that room. And I wonder sometimes how that impacts things when a lot of that stuff really shouldn't matter.
Yeah. Alvarez and Osborne were super influential on the first committee. Both of whom were in the Big Ten and they helped get Ohio State in. And again, Ohio State turned out to be a good choice, but was it, you know, what all went into the choice was a little bit weird.
Yeah. Alvarez will let you know what he thinks.
Oh, yeah.
He'll let you know. All right. Speaking of the future of the playoff, we talked the other day about the excitement when the SEC teams have to play in the North and the what just consternation will go into this. So credit to Billy Napier of Florida, because he's certainly not buying into this. But they play Vanderbilt this weekend in Nashville, and the game time temperature is set to be 43 degrees. And he was asked about it, playing in the cold.
Did they ask about chicken broth? Chicken broth? Are they bringing broth to Nashville?
There was an oddball. Like, Honestly, whatever Elon Musk has going on Twitter, I can hit my algorithm is going to, he'll never figure it out, because a passionate debate about whether chicken broth was food or not erupted in my mentions. I don't even know what, like, how are you going to, I don't know, like, out of nowhere, right? Has that debate ever occurred before in the history of humankind? I don't believe so, but it did for me. So, yeah, but Billy Napier was asked, he says, well, we don't control the weather, whatever the conditions are, we're going to play, you know, whatever. He's like, laugh. But this was an actual question. It's 43.
If you think mid-November in Nashville's chilly, let's have a playoff game in mid-December in Madison.
It's like, put a hoodie on and rake the leaves, man. It's a nice day. You know,
Dan,
like,
Dan, I'm telling you, all right, put a hoodie on and rake the leaves. Dan, I'm telling you, man, these us Gulf Coast people, man, we,
it's gonna if be it gets great.
Dross below 60, man, we that's no fun. We bundle up, man.
Going to be great. I cannot wait. I mean, if this was actually, I mean, and to it wasn't an issue, but somebody thought it was enough to be like, hey, how are you going to handle that 43?
That's amazing. Chicken broth. Mid upper 40s. that's awesome.
It's tough going up to Nashville. I tell you. It's like when they say stuff like, oh, it's always hard to win on the road. Not at Vanderbilt. No, they lose all the games. Tough environment winning on the road. Is it? Is it really? So there's that. All right. I wanted to get back to this because we got it mostly right, which is pretty good for us. On Sunday, this didn't make mathematical sense to me, so I kind of didn't even believe it. There are four contenders in the Big Ten West, back to this tire fire. That's how they stay warm. In the Big Ten West, it's just a dumpster. They like garbage can fires.
Yes,
and they stand around and say, "Who the hell's going to win this thing?" There are four contenders in the Big Ten West, and indeed, I was right. But then I didn't believe myself. None of them control their own destiny, which seems mathematically improbable. But
possible?
I pulled out an abacus, and it's true. It's true. No, but they're all 4-3: Purdue, Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota. No, nobody controls their own destiny. Somebody
so inherently comical and so perfect for that.
Cancel the championship game. Nobody wins the division title.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm still a little I don't like to say it because it doesn't make any sense. Like, what do you mean, right?
I thought it was Iowa on that chart I sent. No?
No. No, Iowa needs help in some way. I think they need Illinois to lose to Michigan.
Michigan, which should happen.
Which should happen. Purdue seems to be in the best spot because they're only playing Northwestern and Indiana.
Right.
Illinois got to go to Michigan, then they get Northwestern. Minnesota's got Iowa and Wisconsin. Iowa has Minnesota and then Nebraska on the Black Friday game. Also, we're not just determining amongst these four teams, they're not just someone's going to win the Big Ten West, apparently. Well, I don't know if that really will happen. There's also an old oaken bucket and a giant Paul Bunyan axe and a pig all on the line. So all sorts of other crap can happen too.
What a division. Oh, it's just incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, think about this. Think how much air we have expended on this podcast alone crushing Iowa's offense for being the worst in the country, and they still might play in the Big Ten championship. They might win the division. It's incredible.
Well, we said if their offense was just bad, they'd be a good team because their special teams and defense are incredible.
Yeah.
And their offense has, I think, gotten too bad. Just not historically horrific.
Against Wisconsin.
Okay, yeah, you're right.
I got all the stats on that one, buddy.
Well, they beat Purdue. They weren't that bad.
Yeah, their offense was decent. They had a two-game flurry of life. It was against Purdue and who else? Northwestern, who was, you know, atrocious. But then against Wisconsin, all the stats from the Wisconsin game are just hysterical. All right, I've got them here somewhere.
I mean, they don't need much to get to win. So I kind of feel like Iowa is going to win this thing. And Kirk Ferentz is going to laugh and all that. Then, like, Ohio State's going to smoke them. But, like, I don't. It's too fun not to look at. completely irrelevant to anything in college football, but it's too fun not to laugh about.
I totally agree. All right, so here was Iowa's stats from the Wisconsin game, which they somehow won by two touchdowns. They had a season-low 146 offensive yards. They had a season-low 2.15 yards per play. They had no drives longer than 39 yards, and they had no plays longer than 19 yards. And they won easily. It's just how they do it. Pick six, long punt return. Wisconsin sucks. Our defense is great. And all of a sudden you win. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it's certainly not a whole lot going on there. Not a whole lot going on there. So anyway, we'll see. Good times ahead. West Virginia fired athletic director Shane Lyons. Been there since 2015. Seems like Neil Brown's tenure would then be precarious. Am I reading that as tea leaves right? Brown was awesome at Troy. Down in Alabama, 3 10-win seasons. He's not been able to get it going at WVU, which is just just in the wrong league. Maybe the Big 12 gets a little better for them when Cincinnati joins and some other East Coast teams. But is West Virginia going to get a new coach? What are we hearing?
Yeah. It doesn't bode well for Neil Brown that the man who hired him, one of the more respected athletic directors in the country, Shane Lyons, is a West Virginia grad from the state and spent some time in the SEC at Alabama for a while and is on most of the most significant NCAA governance committees. He's on the transformation committee that's kind of coming up with policies to transform the NCAA governance. And he's on the board of governors. He's a representative on the board of governors since he is the chair of the Division I Council, which is like the lead legislative arm group of the NCAA. It's shocking and somewhat unprecedented for somebody of that stature to be let go. I think most ADs would say Shane is a top 20 or 30 athletic director in the country. So the fact that he was pushed out, and you know, I think some of it's been written, but you know, I think there are people at West Virginia that certainly want Neil Brown fired. You know, they've been just okay. You know, they 5-7 in his first year in 2019, 6-4, 6-7, and then this year they're 4-6. So at least 4 losses in 3 of the 4 years, at least 6 losses. The thing is, it happened a day after a huge upset of Oklahoma that snapped this long losing streak they had to Oklahoma. But there are people in West Virginia that want Neil Brown gone, and I think that Shane Lyons pushed back on firing Neil Brown. I think he has pushed back a little bit on it. And I don't know if that was the cause of the issues, but I'm sure that was part of it.
Yeah, I can kind of imagine, you know, some sort of meeting where Shane or somebody on his behalf's like, look, man, like I'm one of the most connected people in the NCAA and I have a lot of respect and I know what I'm doing here. And they're like, well, here in West Virginia, we don't care how many committees you're on. We think our football coach sucks and we'd like him fired. And if you're not going to do it, guess what? You're fired too.
Yep.
That may or may not be the way it went down, but it's not hard to imagine that. And, you know, Neil Brown has had long run out of support. And one of the reasons why, they scheduled hard this year. They started with Pitt, lost that game, upset by Kansas. It's 0-2, and it's like the snowball was just rolling at that point. And that was a difficult, too much to overcome. So by now, the fan base is fed up. The problem, and another reason why, okay, Shane Lyons may be on a bunch of committees and stuff, but he also gave Neil Brown a terrible contract extension, which makes him expensive to fire.
Yeah,
and that was one of the big $16 million after this year.
Yeah,
yeah. We see it time and time again. Right, Missouri just gave Eli Drinkwitz a contract extension that makes no sense.
What was that? Where was Drinkwitz going?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We got to give him a contract extension. So who was taking him? And what, you can't replace a guy at that level. Eli's great, great guy, funny guy, but like you can get, it's like value over replacement player in baseball, right? Like, what's the VORP of Eli Drinkwitz? Like, I don't know. Like, plus 0.1 wins a year or something like it. He's just your he's your okay coach. Maybe gets going. This is the problem, man. With these, I mean, I'll say two things about Lions. Like, he hired. You just never know. Like, you can't. That was a great hire.
Yeah,
Neil Brown was not this one hit wonder. He had this great background up tempo coach, very well educated in college, attending the University of Massachusetts. very smart guy. No, 10-3, 11-2, 10-3, his final 3 years at Troy.
Yeah.
So he didn't just have like one season where it all came together, one kid, you know, sometimes you get that and it's like, oh, now I find out his quarterback actually is going to play like 8 years in the NFL. That is a program building. And you say, all right, this is our guy. And that's a great hire. And it doesn't work out. And you go, how the hell is it the AD's fault? Who exactly were they supposed to hire if that isn't it? And so that's the thing. Like, you just don't know. One thing about all these committees these guys sit on, though, I do wonder for ADs. And I've always wondered this about presidents, too. I mean, I have a job. And if I was always like on a committee for something that isn't my employer, work for West Virginia. Do you need to be there? I don't think the team wins anymore if Shane Lyons is not. Like, he's not sitting in there designing the defense or recruiting, but I always wonder about all these guys on all these committees, including the playoff committee. Like, why do I want to lose my AD for 2 days a week?
Right.
To go work somewhere else for somebody else like this. And what advantage do we get out of this? Certainly it can help when like conference realignment's going down and West Virginia got themselves in. But so a weird situation. One more that may now open, may not. I'm just wondering what you guys thought. Jim Leonard got hired at Wisconsin on an interim basis, and it was a little bit of prove yourself. They're 3-2. And as we mentioned, you know, they still have, they still got the Minnesota game. They still got at Nebraska. Let's say they split. Let's say they win. Does he have that job or not? It looked real. I mean, they beat Purdue and Maryland. Those are two good wins in the Big Ten, but then they lose at Iowa. Like, where is he at in that? Could you see that opening or no?
I think it's much more of a question after this last week than it was before that. If you beat Iowa and you're 4-1 as the replacement guy, and you've got, you know, certainly a winnable Nebraska game, possibly winnable Minnesota, I think they want to keep him, is my feeling, is that they're predisposed to wanting to keep him, but lose by two touchdowns to a team that doesn't have a play longer than 19 yards is a pretty big step back. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That exposed Wisconsin's own offensive failings, under which, you know, started under Paul Christ, have not been fixed, clearly. So I think the jury's very much out. And one thing, Wisconsin loves owning Minnesota. That rivalry is a good little upper Midwest, you know, nice rivalry that's not that nice. And they have really dominated the series. PJ Fleck has managed to turn the tables a little bit, but Wisconsin likes owning that. If you lose that game, I think all bets are off.
Yeah, I agree. I kind of think they want him to succeed, and they want to, you know, promote him permanently. And I think early on when they made the hire, the athletic director there at Wisconsin was at least reaching out to, you know, people in the agent world to put together a list, and seemed like he was going to do a full search. And then I think the last few weeks that kind of slowed down because, you know, Wisconsin then were winning, and I think they wanted to just promote him and elevate him. And I wonder now if the search will kind of ramp back up. You hate to think that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you got this short window as an interim coach to prove yourself. And it's funny because if they're playing at Nebraska this week, and that is another interim coach, Mickey Joseph, who I think a lot of people at Nebraska want to get the full-time job too, but that ship feels like it's sailed because he's not going to be able to get them to a bowl now after the loss last week. But it's like this short window you have to prove yourself as an interim coach, and maybe, you know, unfair or not, it is you're graded all off the games and the results of the games.
One more interim trying to get a job, and this might be the long shot, but man, he made a statement Saturday. It was Cadillac Williams at Auburn. Now, they beat Texas A&M. Texas A&M's terrible, but so is it Auburn. But it was a great scene there. And afterwards, he had, I think it was Cole Kubrick did the interview with him on the field, and he just talked about his love for Auburn and the family and the service. Obviously, he's a great player there. It was a very inspiring speech, and he's just a Cadillac's just a very, I don't know, he's a very charismatic. He has a charismatic way of communicating in a very humble voice, if that makes any sense. And it was really good. And it's almost impossible not to root for the guy. And I don't think Auburn wants to hire I don't think the boosters that run that place want to hire Cadillac. But I don't know, man. Like, let's see. They got Western Kentucky this week, and then they got Alabama. Like, can he play? Could he defy the odds and play in? And if not, someone else might be looking and going, geez, this guy's like, you can tell the connection he's got with these players. And he just loves Auburn. And Auburn's a place that maybe could use that. I don't know.
It's fascinating. Yeah, I mean, it's an extreme long shot, I think. Now, but Auburn being Auburn, they do some irrational things sometimes. You beat Alabama, hey, then all of a sudden we're talking about something different, I think. I don't have much anticipation that it would happen at all. You know, Cadillac Williams would be a nostalgia hire, which is usually bad, and in the yep. family hire, which often is bad. But he was part of the 2004 team that went undefeated and never had a chance to play for a national championship. He was a great player. He's a very likable person. He and Cole Kubrick were teammates in 2001. You know, Kubrick was finishing, Cadillac was starting. So they have a connection there. And it was cool to see just the there's two guys that love Auburn right there. But yeah. Do not make a hire based on who loves Auburn. I'm sitting here in Louisville watching Kenny Payne coach the University of Louisville in basketball right now. He was a nostalgia hire who loves Louisville. They're 0-2 losing to Bellarmine and Wright State. So be careful what you do with your nostalgia hires.
Didn't get the third Wagner either.
Oh, no.
Big recruiting win by Kentucky. Yeah. Yeah. All right, finally, the big news of the week is Texas A&M. No, they actually won something. the coach is not Jimbo Fisher.
That's
although
for
I do believe they have thrown immense amounts of NIL money down on these young scholars, student athletes, if you will. They were named the national champions in the international meat judging competition this last week. Congrats to the Aggies. There's a massive upset. Texas Tech had been they're kind of the Alabama of meat judging. But A&M sprung the upset. If you want to know how strong it is down in Texas, they can't play football for crap outside of TCU. But West Texas came in. West Texas A&M came in fourth. You love a state with multiple A&Ms.
Yeah.
That's really it. So, yeah, it was a thing. They got it done to win the meat judging competition. It was held in Nebraska. You want to win there because you want to, you know, get good attention and shore up that recruiting base. Yeah. You want to get that East, you know, Western Nebraska recruiting base. What is meat judging? You say, what is meat judging?
I was about to ask.
I'm reading meatscience.org, which
Here we go.
Yeah, meatscience.org could be a not safe for work site, but it is. you never know. One of these days. This is why we're here to serve. The intercollegiate meat judging program started in 1926 at the International Livestock Exposition in Chicago. And so they have it. They judge all sorts of stuff. So meat judging is meat judging. Like, I'm looking at the judging guidelines here at the American Meat Science Association. Like, processed meat guidelines, sliced bacon. You have to judge the fat to lean ratio, the lean and fat color, the physical defects, and different stuff. And whoever does it the best wins the event, apparently. So, Pat, what is this? You hang around horses.
Boy, a little different kind of meat there. But I will say, like, the best way to judge it, I would think, would be to eat it, you know? But maybe that's not what we're getting at here. So, no, with the help of the Sickos Committee, which, for everybody, if you're on Twitter, they're a quality follow because there's no rabbit hole too small for them to not burrow down into, and this is one of them. They got the, like, breakdown of the judging scores here, and Texas A&M, powerful performance, let me tell you. They won beef grading. Defeated Kansas State was the closest pursuer to them there. They were second in beef judging to K-State. K-State won that. And then they did extremely well in the lamb and pork area as well. Texas A&M first, West Texas A&M second in lamb judging. And Texas A&M beat Illinois and others in pork judging. So, I mean, they are a versatile group. Let's say that. They can get it done with beef, with pork, who knows what all else. So a great triumph for Texas A&M, which I know you said Texas Tech is kind of the Alabama of meat judging, Dan, and that may well be true, but there's some tradition at Texas A&M, which has had a meat judging team since 1938 and has won championships going back as far as 1958. There's some pictures of the old Fighting Texas Aggie meat judging team from 1938 here. It's what an earnest-looking bunch of men in coats and ties, which I don't know why
they send them off to Junction, Texas to just, like, look at meat all day.
That's right.
18 hours a day.
The strong survive that.
Another hour of bone-in pork chop analysis.
A lot of meat sweats in the cabins. They get it done with meat and pork and lamb. But they don't seem to get it done, Pat, with 5 stars. I'm sorry.
No, maybe these are good recruits. We don't know. So they throw a big, huge pork, a pig down, and you have to decide. Like, I'm looking at the real rules here. You have to determine cutability. Chops with great area of exposed lean, little external fat, and a small amount of bone are desirable. You have to then evaluate the color, and then we have to look for the physical defects. Blood splashing, uncured spots, two-toning, and greening should not be present on the exposed cut surface. Coarse texture may result in using of meat carcasses from mature animals or inadequate cooking. So this is what I want to know. When you win the meat judging national championship, and you return to campus, and let's just say we're going to be very, this is some kind of old school stuff, but let's say you're a guy on the team. Do you get to go out to the bars in College Station and say, I won, would you wear like your medal or whatever you get, and be like, I won the meat judging national championship. Do the women of, or the other men, whoever you're preferring to look at you, do you get a little more attention? Does your stature increase or no? What do you think?
Well, two things there. First of all, from what I saw the team picture, it's mostly female.
Well, so, there's a lot of females on the team, so it could be them too.
Yeah.
Would you rather date a woman that knows how to judge her like bone-in pork chop? not a negative. Not a negative.
No. I think it's a huge positive. And having been to College Station, yeah, I would think that would make you an absolute superstar in the quote-unquote bars there. Aggieville or Aggieland or trying to think of the area where the bars are. But
football team sucks, but look at us.
Exactly, right? Who are the fall athletic heroes on campus? The meat judgers. Come on.
Way to go, A&M. Way to go. All right, that's our podcast. I'm hungry now.
Go get a bone-in pork chop.
Bone-in pork chop going my way. Want to give a shout-out to a listener, Nate in Charlotte, and his dad. They listen to every episode and literally, like, break this thing down, apparently. Like, passionate fans of the podcast. He dared me to give him a shout-out. So, Nate and his dad.
That, I'm glad you said that. That reminds me, Ezra, another passionate listener who sent me a very nice email this week.
Yeah, we're getting a lot. I'm not turning this into a regular thing. So the rest of you guys, screw off. But I don't want to be sitting there naming random. Jimmy in Denver. Yeah, we're not doing that. But Nate and the dad, he gets it. It's mainly the dad. I like it. Father, son, fathers and sons bonding over the College Football Inquirer. What is more wholesome and wonderful than that? God bless America. All right, we'll be back to pick some games later in the week. Continue to subscribe. Tell your dad about us or your son. Whatever. We need listeners. Talk to you later.